And once again, I want to thank Zeifman's for hosting this and for sponsoring the wonderful lunch, and Steve for helping to set this up. I am going to pass around the sign-in sheet. If you already signed in with your email address earlier in the series, you don't need to add the email address again. Just leave your name or something, and that'll be good enough. Okay, following up from last time, actually, last time we talked about Misha Para, the issue of reneging on a deal and this potential warning slash curse that a Beis Din might issue on somebody who backs out after partially entering into a deal. And one of the questions that was asked was whether Batei Din, whether courts actually do this nowadays. So I sent out an email earlier this week saying that I'd done a little bit of research, and it does seem like it exists, at least in theory. So I heard from someone here who consulted with a prominent dayan, a prominent judge on the Toronto Beis Din, and I also spoke with the director of the Beis Din of America in New York, the Rabbinical Council of America's Beis Din. And in both cases, the answer seems to be they wouldn't do it in so many words. In other words, you wouldn't go to a Beis Din and say, someone did this, or is doing this now, he should receive a Misha Para. What I did hear, though, is that it might be worded in the ruling of the Beis Din in a case in which someone acted that way. In other words, the Beis Din, in the context of its ruling, may say, so-and-so did this and is worthy of this Misha Para warning because of what they did. Okay. So, priorities in tzedakah. First of all, are there any sheets left? I printed up, I think, 24, 25 of them, so there should be. If anyone still needs a sheet, there. No, that's where the missing one is. Okay, good. So what I don't expect to discuss are the issues of deductions and tzedakah. In other words, what counts towards your 10%. What counts towards your income from which you will take 10%. That we did actually as part of a series here in late 2011, and presumably it's on Kosher Zoop as well as YU Torah. So you can find that there. What I wanted to talk about instead are, as it says in the title, priorities in tzedakah, figuring out how we're supposed to give. And this is a huge, huge topic. We're taking three particular questions. Number one, is it better to give many small gifts or one large contribution? Number two, the question of whether it's better to give to an umbrella fund, a communal umbrella fund, like a federation type of a thing, and then they will distribute, or a rabbi's benevolent fund, or whether it's better for you to actually distribute it yourself. And then one little note at the end, the Israel versus local, just because that's a question that comes up a lot. Where should I be providing most of my tzedakah? And then at the end, after that, I expect to give you a little bit of the Baltimore guidelines. If you take a look at the top of your sheet, you'll see the Rabbi Moshe Heineman wrote up a set of guidelines that the community in Baltimore uses. I don't know, everybody uses it if they're just guidelines for the community. Let's be fair about how communities observe the guidelines that are set for them. But it is a set of guidelines, and I found it particularly helpful, so I will discuss those a little bit at the end. In that section on your sheet of useful links, the three other links that are there are to articles, or in the last case, a book on tzedakah, on giving one's mice or giving one's tithe, and they're all very useful in different ways. I highly encourage you to take a look at them. The last one that's listed there, Meiser Ksafim, I initially listed Cyril Dom as Rabbi Doctor. I was then corrected via email. He was not a rabbi. He passed away last year. He was not a rabbi, just a professor. But when you read the book, you'll never know it. It is absolutely brilliant, and I highly recommend it. Okay. So let's get started on our topic. Many gifts or one large contribution. So what is the goal of giving tzedakah? When I give tzedakah, what am I trying to accomplish? This isn't a trick question.
Hopefully
poverty. Help alleviate poverty, right? I want to make sure that those who need food will have food, those who need clothing will have clothing. That's a very basic understanding of the goal of tzedakah. And indeed, if you take a look at source number one, you get one of the Torah's several instances in which it talks about this. Kilo yechdal evyon mikerav haaretz. The pauper will never disappear from the midst of the land. Al kein anochi mitzavacha. Therefore, God says, I instruct you. Leimor pasoach tivtach es yoncha leachicha la'aniecho levyoncha be'artzecha. Open up your hand to your brother, your pauper, your indigent person in your land. Notice, by the way, the emphasis on your. It's an association with you. In other words, a person cannot say, I am at a remove, I am at a distance, and the pauper is over there. The person has to relate to the needy person. He's yours. Your responsibility, your brother, even. And that's a very important point in terms of how we give our tzedakah. Parenthetically, this is one of two apparently contradictory verses. Another verse, just a few sentences before this in the Torah, says, "Efes ki lo yihye b'cha evyon." There will be no pauper among you. And that leads the Talmud to discuss, how could it be? Is it that there will never be one? Is it that there will be one and you're responsible to help him? Either way, your goal is to aid the needy. And that's certainly one of the goals of tzedakah. But it's not the only goal of tzedakah. What is another reason to give tzedakah, another goal in giving tzedakah?
Get back to davening.
Sorry?
Get back to davening.
What do you mean? To get back to davening. Okay. You know, the solution is to do what they do in Israel. I haven't seen people do it here. Actually, no, I did it in 1 minute. I did see it here, which is you come into davening, you put your coins or whatever it is down on the table. Someone comes by, you just push them over. That assumes you have a table. But then you know in advance what you're going to give. That's the amount that you have to give, and that's how you take care of it. Yeah, you got to carry coupons, but that's fine. You have the coupons in your pocket. Make it as easy as possible for yourself.
Try and improve your character traits by getting in the habit of helping other people.
Right. So that's a second goal, is to develop your own character, and specifically your own mercy. If you take a look at source number two, the pasuk in Tehillim, classic, Tov Hashem lakol v'rachamav al kol ma'asav. Hashem is good to all. His mercy is upon all of his deeds, all of his creations. And we are taught to emulate God, and therefore we have to develop our mercy. Giving tzedakah helps us to develop our mercy. Take a look, please, at source number three. Rabbi Aaron Halevi, author of the Sefer HaChinuch. You don't need to sign in if you're already down and your email address is down and so on. Okay. HaKadosh Baruch Hu ratza liyos amo asher bachar mi'utarim b'chol mida tova v'yikara. God wanted his nation that he chose to be crowned with every good and precious trait. And that they should have a spirit of blessing, a generous spirit. This is, by the way, in the context of discussing the mitzvah of Peah. The mitzvah of Peah requires that a farmer leave the corner of his field to the needy. So that's what this is, that's what he's commenting on, and you'll see why that's relevant in a moment. Uchvar kasabti ki miso ha-pa'ulos tispoel ha-nefesh. He says, I've already written, and indeed he writes this quite a bit, that a person's spirit is affected by the deeds he performs. His spirit will become good. Hashem's blessing will be upon it. The Ein Safek, he says, there is not a doubt. That when a person leaves a portion of his produce in his field, and he renders it ownerless, so that those who need it will be able to get it. He will see within himself a satisfaction of spirit and a good and proper spirit and a blessed spirit. A feeling that Hashem has actually given him of his goodness. And his spirit will rest in goodness. And what he means by that is, not only that are you giving tzedakah, but you're not taking everything for yourself. So in other words, here's my field. I go out to the field, I'm harvesting the grain, and I stop short. And I say, the rest of it is going to be for somebody else. That's a very important means of training myself in not trying to get every last thing for myself, but instead being benevolent towards others. And he concludes the thought, if somebody gathers it all into his house, he doesn't leave anything for the needy people who saw the field filled with grain, right, and who wanted it. They were so hungry and they kept hoping and hoping, and now he takes it all for himself. He demonstrates without a doubt a bad spirit in himself by taking it all for himself. So the idea is that we are meant to train ourselves to be merciful. That's the goal. And continuing, take a look at source number 4. It's an application outside of the mitzvah of tzedakah, but it's an important point that follows the same lines. Mitzvah as training for yourself. Ohev lifrok v'sonei lidon. I have a mitzvah that if I see an animal struggling under a burden, I'm supposed to unload the burden from the animal. And if I see that someone is trying to put the burden on his animal, I'm supposed to help him load the animal. That's my requirement. But he says here, the Torah words these mitzvahs by talking about what you do if you see an oyev, if you see an enemy, or the enemy's donkey. So he says, Ohev lifrok. If you see your friend's animal needs to be unburdened, visone liton, and your enemy's animal needs the burden loaded onto it, mitzvah bisone. The mitzvah is to take care of the enemy's animal. Kedei lachof es yitzro, in order to control one's spirit. Meaning, it's better for me to help my enemy than to help my friend. In both cases, I have performed an act of kindness, but here, I've also worked on myself to try to reduce that animosity that's within me. So that's a very important point. Again, it's mitzvah as self-improvement. That's a basic principle for the Jew. And that's one application of this idea that we give in order to develop our mercy. Another is a technical point seen in source number 5. We saw in source number 1 the mitzvah of tzedakah was framed as being la'achicha la'aniyach, for your brother. So what about someone who's not your brother? What about someone who's not Jewish? So therefore the Rambam makes the point in source number 5 that absolutely we help them as well. I'm not going to read it all out. You can see it there in number 5, but note the part where he quotes the verse v'rachamav al kol ma'asav, Hashem's mercy is for everybody, not only for Jews. We are meant to also help those who are not Jewish. Even though the pasuk that I quoted before was la'achicha, for your brother, it extends even beyond your family. And so that's a second element, is giving for the sake of mercy. And then there is a third element. And the third element introduces us to a particular subtopic within tzedakah. And that's called ma'aser k'safim. We often confuse the two. It's important to keep them separate. Tzedakah means I give to help someone in need. Ma'aser k'safim means that I take 1/10 of my income and I give it to help others. The difference between the two is that tzedakah is only triggered when I see somebody in need. If I don't see someone in need, then I don't have a mitzvah of go out looking. It would be just a good thing to do. But tzedakah, strictly speaking, is you're aware of a need, you fill it. Ma'aser k'safim says, take off 10% of your income and allocate that as money to be given. Whenever you find somebody in need, wherever you find them, that's what you're going to use in order to help somebody else. Ma'aser k'safim is based on the verse that I bring you in source number 6. Aser ta'aser es kol tuas zarecha. This is the mitzvah of ma'aser ani. The rule is that when dealing with Israeli produce, I'm supposed to take off a certain percentage and give it to a kohen. That's called truma. I'm then supposed to take off another 10% and give it to the levi. That's called maaser rishon, the first tithe. Then after that, there's an additional 10%. Every 3 years, there's a cycle that repeats itself, where the first 2 years, I take that second tithe, and I bring it to Yerushalayim and eat it there. If it's too far to go, then I redeem it for cash. I bring the cash to Yerushalayim, and I buy food there, and I eat the food there. But in the third year of this three-year cycle, it becomes what's called Maaser Ani, and that's what's being described here. It has to be given to the needy. So that's a biblical mitzvah of giving a tenth of my produce to the or this tenth of the produce to the needy. And based on that, we have a practice of giving 10% of our income to the needy, even though it's not produce. Right? The money that we made, whatever it was, likely didn't, you know, it isn't wheat. Nonetheless, we are giving it to the needy person. There's some debate as to exactly how we understand this practice of giving the 10%. Source number 7, the Hebrew is on one side, the English is on the other. The comment of Rabbi Obadiah Mibartanura to a Mishnah in Peah, he talks about all sorts of biblical mitzvot of helping others, and in it, he includes the mitzvah of, or the practice of, Maaser Ksafim, of giving this one-tenth up to one-fifth, which is its own discussion, not for right now. But he includes this as being just like the other mitzvahs. He seems to view it as a biblical mitzvah, giving one-tenth. That's the minority view. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, in source number 8, in his Aruch HaShulchan, says it's not biblical, it's actually a rabbinic mitzvah. And he says it's not actually from Aser to Aser at all, the verse that I brought you before. He says where it's actually from is when Yaakov is running away from Esav. When Yaakov makes a vow, he says, God, if you help me and so on, whatever you give me, whatever help you're going to provide for me, Asera Aserenu Lach, I am going to give one-tenth back to you. You can't give the money back to God, but I'm not going to keep it, I'm going to give it away instead. And on that basis, the Aruch HaShulchan says, the rabbi said, that's our basis for giving away 10% to those in need. Rabbi Avram Tzvi Hirsch Eisenstadt in his Pischei Tshuva to the Shulchan Aruch in source number 9 says, I don't know what you're talking about, it's not biblical, it's not rabbinic, it's simply a custom. Giving the 10%. That matters for reasons beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss in depth today, but I'll just pinpoint one thing. If you call it a custom, giving 10%, that means that your practice, your communal practice, for what counts and doesn't count in the 10%, is binding on those who come along and now are going to start giving. So in other words, if there's a communal custom of saying we count day school tuition as within the 10%, and I'm not saying we do, but if there were such a communal custom, then people would be justified and say, well, that's the minhag. The whole thing is minhag. Therefore, this counts as part of the minhag. This counts as part of the custom. There are even those who will suggest, and major halakhic authorities among them, that it's not even a communal custom. It's personal. And therefore, when we first become economically independent, whatever age that is, and we start making money, we set down for ourselves what we include and what we don't include, and you can write your own rules, because it's your personal vow. So again, I said, I'm not getting into that in detail, but it matters whether you say this is biblical or rabbinic or custom, actually shapes the way we give tzedakah. It's an important thing to think about. But going back to our main point here, we have three different goals in giving tzedakah. Number one, help those in need. Number two, work on our own attributes, work on our character, make sure that we develop the mercy that emulates Hashem. And then number three, we're honoring this mitzvah of tithing by extending it to all income, even beyond grain. And that brings with it certain elements as well. Because when it comes to tithing, you're supposed to actually make a precise calculation. We are taught you're not supposed to tithe approximately and just say, well, I'll give and this covers it. Tithing is supposed to be done precisely when you're dealing with grain, and therefore it's supposed to be done that way when you're dealing with tzedakah as well. But let's bring this back now to our initial question. Many gifts or one gift? Based on what we've said so far about the goals of tzedakah, what would you say? Should you give your tzedakah in many small gifts, or should you give it in one big gift? Sorry? Many gifts. Why?
To improve yourself.
Yeah, but you can make another counter argument is that if you're looking at it from the point of helping the recipient, it could be one large gift, could be could make a big difference. Mm-hmm. A lot of little gifts might be insignificant and may not make much difference, even if it's the same total.
Didn't they give the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago to microloan people who extended microloans? So their argument will be now that the small gifts also benefit more. Actually, take a look at source number 10. No, that's true. Dory knows that you won't get your name on the building. This is so.
Not in this world.
So, kolanosein matanosav lakohen echad mevi ra'av la'olam. The Talmud says, when you have tithes to give, it's talking about truma here that goes to the kohen. So, if a person gives all his tithes to one kohen, he brings famine to the world. So writes the Talmud, and that's actually quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch in Yeredeh, where they talk about the laws of giving tzedakah, records this as law that one should give to many recipients, the goal here being to maximize the benefit of the aid that you provide. The goal is, indeed, you're right, it's true, if I gave one person $10,000, I'd be helping him a whole lot, as opposed to giving, you know, whatever subdivision you want to give of that to more people. However, it's worthwhile to help everybody a little bit. That's the economic view taken in the Talmud there. The Rambam, though, picks up on what Moshe picked up on in source number 11. This is from the Rambam, from Maimonides' commentary to Pirkei Avot. The Mishnah there that he's commenting on said, "Hakol lefi rov ha-ma'aseh," that what one does is valuable based on the magnitude of one's deeds, but not magnitude in terms of size, magnitude in terms of number. The more deeds you perform, the better off you are. So take a look at what the Rambam says. He says that he makes the same point that we saw in the Sefer HaChinuch. Keep in mind, the Sefer HaChinuch that we saw in source number 3, Rabbi Aaron Halevi, who is credited with writing the Sefer HaChinuch, very often quotes the Rambam. So what he said in that source likely stems from something along these lines in source number 11. Hamalos lo yusagu lefi shir godel hamasa, ela lefi rov mispar hamasa. He says great qualities are not achieved via great deeds, but via a great number of deeds. And he goes on for a bit and then continues. I wanted it all to fit on one page, but you can see it in the original. Mashal azeh shehaadam im yitein lemisha ra'i elef dinar bepam achas uliish echad lo tusag lo malas hanedivus bazeh hamaaseh ha'echad agadol. He says if one were to give to an appropriate recipient 1,000 dinar at once to one party, he would not achieve the level of generosity in that single large deed, kemosha tusaglamishi is nadev elef pa'amim be'elef dinar, that one will achieve if he gives 1,000 times out of that same 1,000 dinar. V'iten kol dinar mehem altzad hanedivus, giving each one generously. And that last note, I think, is actually important, because you don't want a situation in which a person is going to give these tiny gifts and not give them generously. In other words, when people make a large donation, so they certainly do it in a very magnanimous way. The magnanimity of it is very clear. Here's a check for 1,000 dinar. Whereas, you give someone 1 dinar, there's a possibility that it's kind of not such a generous act at all. So he's saying, no, you give each time with that spirit of, I'm giving of myself, I want to help somebody else, making a connection with the person. You do that 1,000 times, the Rambam makes the psychological observation, it will have more of an impact on you than if you do the one big gift. When I was in the shul rabbinate, at one point in one of the communities I lived in, there was a certain organization that moved into town. And the existing organizations were very upset, because they said, well, it's going to take away from the tzedakah in the community. And the person who was raising funds for the organization disagreed. He said, people need to get into the habit of writing a check. They need to get into the habit of reaching into their pockets. And what I am doing is providing them with another opportunity to do so. Maybe new people, maybe people who weren't doing it as frequently. And that will, in the end, habituate them to keep on giving. Clearly when he said it was self-serving, but I think he's right. I think it's true
that certainly, you know, when I lived in Pennsylvania, I used to make fundraising calls for the local UJA, and I asked for the $0 cards. The reason being because it couldn't get any worse. I wouldn't be letting anybody down if I didn't get anywhere. But the hardest thing was to get someone from 0 to 5, 0 to 10, 0 to 18. Once people are already in the habit of giving, it's easier to get them to go further with it. And that's what the Rambam is saying here. That's the Rambam's observation, and therefore that's a second reason to say you're going to give many small gifts rather than a single large gift. Yes. Right. So that's an interesting economic argument, and I definitely hear it. I wonder whether there wouldn't be a response, though, of if you give the guy his first meaningful bite, that's great, but in 6 hours he's hungry again. Whereas if you give him the big donation, sorry? They have to give him another bite. I'm just, you understand what I'm saying? I'm not sure how this works in terms of impact on the community. That's why I hesitated before in terms of saying that this is the way to maximize the aid. The microloans suggest that it is, but I'm sure there's an argument on the other side for how I'm benefiting society and where the greater impact is. Maybe if I help one person and that person becomes an employer and then is able to hire others and so you need to be an economist in order to answer the question of what's going to benefit the community more. But in terms of what benefits the donor, in terms of helping to develop his character, the Rambam's point is giving many small gifts will have the greater impact. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his comment on this section in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, notes an additional reason to give to many rather than one, and that's to avoid charging favoritism. Right? Meaning you give to this one cause, you don't give to the other, it can create hostility. So it's another reason to spread it around. Okay. So that's our many gifts versus one gift. The second question, the question of giving to an umbrella fund versus giving directly to the needy. So based on what we've said so far about the goals of tzedakah, where we defined three, right? Aiding the needy, developing our mercy, and mimicking maaser ksafim, maaser ani, mimicking the tithe. What would be best? An umbrella fund or giving directly to the needy?
Giving directly to the needy.
Because?
Because, first of all, you're giving more often, separately, right? And one of the advantages of all of the whole purposes of an umbrella fund is to make it easy for someone to make one large gift and not give to a lot of individual people. So once you go, if you feel the umbrella fund is, so that goes against this idea we're talking about that you were doing more often, smaller amounts more often, is.
That's one argument. Other arguments? Yes.
By giving an umbrella fund, you don't have the connection with the honey.
Right. Right, the umbrella fund insulates you. You never see the needy person at all. And that's certainly so, that people will give more, right? The whole idea behind those commercials that they started running on television decades ago where they would show you the child in Africa, right, was to give you that kind of a connection to the person that will lead you to give and to give more. Yes. Right. I debated with myself whether to bring that in this shiur, because really it's worthy of its own shiur, but it's true. The Rambam defines 8 levels of tzedakah, and in prioritizing the different levels, one is he prioritizes the type of giving. The ideal is where you give someone a job or something that will help them become economically independent. And the ideal is that it be done anonymously, preferably with neither side knowing, which would then favor the umbrella fund. Because I don't know who's getting and the recipient doesn't know who's giving. So from that perspective, you're right. The umbrella fund would be better. So from a...
So gives to many organizations which you may not be able to know to give.
Right. And that is what really swings the day. The expertise that goes with the umbrella fund. Because from a Musar perspective, from an ethical perspective, in terms of my own development and even my own generosity, it will probably be better for me to give directly. But the problem is that unless you're a professional, unless you dedicate real effort to identifying needs, you're not going to be able to give appropriately because you don't know what the needs are. You end up giving to the first thing that comes to hand, and that's it. Now you've, or now we said we're savings for 1,000 different little gifts. But you know, do you really know what the needs are? The answer is generally no. And because of that, the tendency in Jewish history has been to go with the umbrella fund. If you take a look, I'm jumping sources to number 14. I'm going to come back to 12 and 13 in a moment. But if you take a look at number 14, the Rambam writes, "May olam lo ra'inu v'lo shamanu b'kahal miYisrael she'ein lahen kupa shel tzedakah." He says, "We have never seen or heard of a Jewish community that didn't have a kupa shel tzedakah, a tzedakah fund." Now, the word kupa is actually a technical term. So let me take you back now to, I'll do it outside of the text because it'll be easier that way. The word kupa is a term for a weekly fund that was taken up by the people in the community. Every member of the community, we'll define membership in a couple of minutes, but every member of the community will be required to contribute money to this fund that was distributed once a week to the needy. There was a separate fund called a tamchui. And a tamchui was a soup kitchen. It was actual food. They would go door to door collecting food, and every day that would be distributed. And what the Rambam is saying here, if I would have brought you the full line, but I lacked the space. But what the Rambam says is everyone has the weekly cash fund. Not every community has the food, the daily food one. That may depend on need and ability to provide. But everyone has the weekly cash fund. He says there's no such thing as a Jewish community that doesn't do this. Now let's go back to source number 12. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. The first quote, "Kol ir sheyesh ba Yisrael," every city with Jews in it, "chayavim lahamid mehem gabai tzedakah," is responsible to appoint tzedakah collectors. The word gabai is a collector. And that's sort of come full circle, since the gabai ends up handing out the cards when you get the aliyah that you have to put the paperclip on to tell them how much you're going to give. So the gabai, once again, has become a gabai. But in any case, they have to appoint gabai tzedakah, collectors of tzedakah, anashim yeduim v'ne'emanim, they have to be known, credible people. Emphasis on them being known to everybody, and they have to be people who the community will trust. Leading to the next piece here in source number 12. The Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's the initial author of the Shulchan Aruch, writes, "Ve'ein mechashvin bitztaka im gabai tzedakah." He says, we don't demand accounts from the tzedakah collectors. No transparency. The Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, comes along and says, not so fast, writing very briefly after shortly after Rabbi Yosef Karo, in the Ashkenazi addendum to the Shulchan Aruch, he writes, "Haga, umikol makom kedei sheyiyu nikiyim mehashem umiyisrael tov lahem litein cheshbon." He's actually quoting the Torah, an earlier code of law. He says, you know, there is a principle of being innocent in the eyes of God and Israel. That's a biblical sentence. You are required to be innocent in the eyes of others, to take steps to make sure that you will be above suspicion. And therefore, he says, it's good to present an account. Now, that just means it's good to, not required. But then he says, "V'chol zeh begabayim haksherim." And that assumes you're dealing with collectors who are known to be righteous. They have a stellar reputation. "Avol misha'eino kasher." But if someone is not known to be above board, not that we know he's bad. If we know he's bad, he has no business being the gabay tzedakah. But if you have someone who hasn't been tested yet, doesn't have a good reputation yet, we don't know. "Oshinis mana be'almus v'chazaka," or perhaps he got the position by force, someone with a lot of communal pull who ends up being in charge, then "tsarech litein cheshbon," they are required to present an account of their tzedakah fund. "V'huadin b'chom emunim al hatzibur," and by the way, the same is true for all communal appointees. There's more in terms of the requirements for tzedakah collectors. So the Gemara talks about requiring that there be a minimum of 2 involved at the time of the collection and 3 involved in the allocation. And the reason for that is to make sure that you have somebody watching. Even if the community doesn't have an account of what's going on, as per the Mechaber, there have to be those who have the oversight. Someone's doing an audit.
You have to have that that option there. We need.
We would call it an internal control.
There you go.
Internal
control. I have to be careful using technical terms. But yes, the idea is it has to be done in a professional way. It can't be done in a loose way. And that's what we're relying on when we do the umbrella fund, is to get someone who's going to be able to do that. People in charge who are going to be responsible. And take a look at source number 13. All right, Moshe Feinstein was asked the question of whether it's a good idea to form a federated fund in a community doing this umbrella. So Moshe wrote in source number 13, Nira lefiani is daiti pashut. It appears clear in my humble opinion. Shamakor lechiyuv zeh, that the proof of this obligation, the word makor usually means source, but here he means it as a proof. The proof that you are obligated to create such funds comes from Hadesanya b'Bava Basra Dav Ches, from a passage in the Talmud which says Shloshim yom letamchoi gimel chadashim lekupa. It says there that if you've lived in a city for 30 days, you are obligated to give to the tamchoi, that's the food collection, and after 3 months, you're obligated to give to the kupa, the weekly cash collection. V'im leka chiyuv al b'nei ha'ir la'asos kupa eich shaykh l'chayev le'elo abo'im achar kach. He says, if there is no obligation to create such funds, the community just chose to, then how could you mandate that new people who move in after the community's made this decision should also have to give? It can't be that we're obligating newcomers as a result of an old agreement of the people in town, he says. Rather, it must be that there's a separate obligation that Jewish communities have to set up such funds to benefit the needy. Now, you could argue this point. There are ways that we could argue this point. You could argue it's overall social contract, and anybody who moves in is agreeing to the rules, Dina de Malchusa type of a setup, and there are various sources that support that. You could make that argument against Rav Moshe's point here. But Rav Moshe is adamant in his responsum that we have to set them up. He also knows that the purpose of having such a fund is to help the needy, not to hurt them. And therefore, he says, and I know this will not be popular in the various shuls, but it's true, he says that setting up a fund cannot become an excuse to hurt the individual needy person, so that you say, now you have to go to the fund person and you're not allowed to go door to door anymore. He says that you're not allowed to do. So I know that various communities have done that, and I recommend they ask the shul rabbi. But that's Rav Moshe's stance. Rav Moshe says you can't say, well, I'm going to have a communal fund and now people can't go door to door anymore. The purpose of the communal fund is to help them, not to harm them. So in terms of the question of, is it better to give to an umbrella fund? The answer is that hypothetically, giving directly to the needy would be great. But in practice, because you need the experts and you need the accountability, therefore, it's better to actually use a communal fund, again, not at the expense of the needy person, but in order to be able to help, make sure that we actually reach and help the needy person.
So, in the sense you're saying, both are required.
Yeah.
Yeah, give to both.
Right.
Question.
Yeah.
The part about reporting back to the community, the Gabbai Tzedakah reports back to the community. So I would have thought that having a Gabbai Tzedakah not only is to make the process more efficient, but maybe to assure anonymity. Mm. So if a Gabbai gives out to 10 poor people in a given month and then tells everybody who gave the money to account to the donors,
right,
what about the anonymity and the self-respect of the donors?
Right. So accounting can be done while retaining anonymity. I mean, what I used to do when I had a Rabbi's Benevolent Fund was that I would log who I was giving to, not based on the person's name, but based on the type of gift that it was. And that way it was something where there was a record of the type of assistance being provided without a record of the name of the recipient. And that was a way to solve it. I know of shuls where there's one other person besides the rabbi who has access to the account. And that person is able to know what's going on and see the checks and so on.
I mean, I wouldn't have expected that someone is reporting back the names of the poor people who are being given funds. But without that, it's a little bit silly to say, yeah, we gave to 10 people this month. So it's not really a very rigorous reporting on the activities.
Right. No, that's true. That's true. To really make it rigorous, you would have to actually be able to cross-check. And that would require then that you have somebody else who has access to it. Right. I mean, in ours, we had it hypothetically because the shul secretary had access also.
But realistically, she wasn't, you know, going in and looking at the checkbook and the canceled checks. Didn't. Although, maybe the answer is, you go back to the, what he said about the ksherim. In other words, where you know you have someone who's been checked and been good, then you don't need to keep that kind of, that level of exact observation. Maybe you do a spot check here and there, but you don't need it on an ongoing basis. Maybe. Last of our points. Israel versus local. So if you take a look at source number 15, you see the straightforward statement in the Shulchan Aruch, which says, "V'yoshvei Eretz Yisrael kodmen liyoshvei chutzal haaretz." Israelis precede those who live outside of Israel. When it says Israelis, that doesn't mean you have an Israeli passport. It means you live in Israel. The Rav Kook, in his Das Kohen, response from Kuflamid Gimel 133, explains that the idea is simply that the needy of Israel are considered to be Aniyei Ircha. They're considered to be like the needy in your own city. So there is a hierarchy in general. We say first one is supposed to give to family. Family is supposed to have the top claim on your tzedakah. Obviously, if you can help them without it being tzedakah, that's even better. But a person doesn't have enough to be able to do that. First claim on your tzedakah money is immediate family. Then after immediate family, less immediate family. Beyond that, it's local citizens. And then beyond that, it is, as you see here, Israelis, as the Shulchan Aruch sees it, the Das Kohen, Rav Kook, says actually Israelis count as Aniyei Ircha. They're like your local needy people. And then, with all the money you have left over, once you've taken care of all of those populations, then you go beyond. And the Chasam Sofer actually wrote that Yerushalayim has precedence over the rest of Israel, having to do with the holiness of the city. The Shach, Rav Shabtai Cohen, writing in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, says that actually it's local first, and then Israel. Meaning that it's not Israel equals local, the way Rav Kook would formulate it, but rather that it's local first, and then Israel. One thing that I do want to note with it is that the Chafetz Chaim wrote a work called Avas Chesed, Love of Generosity. And he writes there that all the rules go out of the window when a needy person is in front of you and needs immediate help, dire help. So if someone comes to you and they don't have money for food, they don't have money for clothing, that person is going to have a primary claim on your immediate tzedakah. Whether they're from here, whether they're a relative, whether they're from Israel, doesn't make a difference. The rules go out the window once you've hit that point. Okay. So what we've said is then, number one, many smaller gifts over one large gift. Number two, better to give to an umbrella fund, but not to the point where now the needy who are being overlooked are stuck. And Israelis are either the same as those in your city or right after those who are in your city. The last thing that I wanted to do was go through the guidelines from Rav Heinemann, because I really found them to be very useful. That's the one that has the link at the top of your sheet. So Rav Heinemann, Rav Moshe Heinemann, is best known probably as the rabbinic authority of the Star K, the Vadak Hashrut in Baltimore. He offered the following set of rules. Number one, that at least half of one's tzedakah money should be given in town to local institutions. Then he said that one should divide one's tzedakah in thirds. And this will not necessarily conflict with the point about at least half being in town. But the way he suggested it is, one third goes to needy individuals or institutions in your community. The second third is what he called moral obligations, wherever they may be. So he included in that a needy relative, a close friend, an institution maybe where your kids went to school, the question that you had asked before we started, an institution where you went to school, your children went to school, particularly if they did not have to pay full tuition, an institution from which you've had direct benefit or a person from whom you've had direct benefit, or an institution that is owned or directed by a relative or close friend who you feel you have a responsibility to help. So those are sort of the moral obligation ones, where you have a personal connection, and particularly where you have been a beneficiary. Those have a claim on the second one-third of it. And then the third third would go to any qualified individual or institution as long as you make sure to that again, 50% of your tzedakah is going, at least 50% is going in town. But then he said the rest of it, you know, the last one third can go anywhere. What I particularly like about what Rabbi Heinemann does with this is not even the specifics of what he's putting where, as the fact that he has specifics. Meaning that, in general, and I believe I said this 2 years ago when we had the discussion about tzedakah and deductions, tzedakah should be run like a business. It's not something to just sort of do haphazardly. Meaning that you look at your earnings and you have a fiscal period, whether that's done quarterly or whether it's done annually, whatever your system is, but you have a system and say, this is what I should be giving away, and now I'm going to analyze where it's best to give it away and how best to do it. One of the articles I gave you, I believe, the second article on the list, Principles of Ethics, Governance, and Accountability, includes within it a section on something you made reference to a little bit when we talk about umbrella funds, and the issue of how funds should be run and giving to funds that have overhead and what percentage of overhead is considered to be acceptable. And guidelines that are sort of a hybrid of good accounting principles and Torah sources. And I highly recommend that piece. It should be done in a serious way. And so the fact that he's willing to give this particular rules and say one third here, one third here, one third here, is to me encouraging, and I think it's something that should be pursued. Thank you very much.
Okay, on behalf of everyone, I'd like to thank Robert Tafuder for this wonderful series.